April 18th. We get going early so we can be the first ones on the monster. But as we're driving up, I read in the Sunday paper that there's no BP today. While it doesn't mention it anywhere, and even the Sox ticket office and the guys who let us in through Gate C aren't sure where we're supposed to go, it's on-field photo day. We take a right toward the stairs up to the monster and notice the garage door to center's open. We fall in behind a staff member escorting two kids, and then we're on the warning track in the bright sunshine. A yellow rope cordons off the grass, but we can walk all the way around to the dugout, where Schilling is sitting, being interviewed by a writer. The PA tells us the plan. The Sox will come out and walk all the way around so we can take photos. Each player has a handler to make sure they don't sign autographs. Still, I've got to try. No, I'll get in trouble, Bill Miller says, like a little kid. The guys are nice, shaking hands and posing. I get Steph with hitting coach Ron Papa Jack Jackson and Keith Falk. Trudy's being crowded and can't get clean shots, so she moves out to the warning track and right where it's empty. Johnny Pesky's sitting in the dugout with Andrew, and I toss him a ball to sign. I notice Manny on the other end of the dugout signing and make my way over there, scissoring over the wall and then high-stepping over the railings between sections. The mob around him is packed tight, but I finally get through and have him sign my ball. The monster seats are a dream. A counter for your stuff, a swiveling bar stool, and room behind it to stand or lean against the wall. We're in the second row. In the first row, there are new signs that read, "Warning, for your safety, please do not reach over wall." The one drawback is that we're a long way from the plate. It's a little breezy, but when the wind is blowing right, you can smell the burgers grilling. The sun's out, Lowry's with us, and when Kevin Millar doubles into the corner in the first, scoring Bill Miller, the day seems ideal. The pitching matchup's in our favor, or should be. Contreras is their fourth starter, and a weak link. The worry is that Lowe, working on 10 days' rest, will be too strong and leave the ball up. In the third, that's exactly what happens. After he walks A-Rod, he gives up a single to Giambi, a double to Sheffield, a single to Matsui, and a double to Posada, all of them down the line and left. Lowe strikes out Travis Lee, but Enrique Wilson singles to right, scoring Matsui to make it 4-1. Jeter grounds out, scoring Posada. Then Bernie Williams doubles down the left field line. That's it for Lowe. 2 2/3 innings, 8 hits, 7 runs. The Sox get 2 back in the bottom of the inning, chasing Contreras. We should have more except for a blown call. With 2 on and 2 out, Tech slaps one down the first baseline that Travis Lee has to dive to spear. Reliever and ex-Sox Paul Quantrill beats Tech to the bag, but Lee has trouble getting the ball out of his glove, and by the time the throw arrives, Quantrill's well past the base. The ump punches Tech out to end the inning, bringing Francona from the dugout to argue, though by then it's pointless. Also, during this inning, the Yanks haul out their Cuban national team tactics, slowing down the pace of the game in the middle of our rally to quiet the crowd and throw off the hitter's timing. Posada visits the mound. They send the trainer out in mid-count, as if the pitcher has some injury. He doesn't, but because the trainer accompanies Torrey, the visit doesn't count as a visit by the manager. They send the pitching coach. They change pitchers. They have an infield conference. They send the pitching coach again in mid-count. The pitcher himself wanders behind the mound to stall. They change pitchers again. Technically, it's only semi-legal, a judgment call with the league's new rules requiring umps to pick up the pace of the game. A good crew chief wouldn't put up with this nonsense. It stays 7-3. There's not much action, and the crowd's grumpy and distracted. From time to time, the bleachers rise and roar, signaling a fight. The cops haul some Yankee fans away, and everyone cheers, "Yankees suck! Yankees suck." In the 7th, Tom Gordon comes into some moderate booze, but it's hard to get too excited down by 4 runs. The sole highlight of the late innings is an awkward sliding catch by Sheffield along the right field line. The crowd salutes him with the old Atlanta tomahawk chop, with the finger attached. We lose 7-3. It was basically a one-inning game, over after the 3rd. The loss can't ruin the day. Walking on the field, seeing the guys sitting on the monster. But it makes for a quiet ride home. And tomorrow's their matchup. Kevin Brown against Bronson Arroyo. Okay, now who's the fatalist? I get an email from Steve.
not quite so good today. And with Kay Brown tomorrow, the Yanks look good for the split. Curse them.
It was a dull game, even up on the monster. The wind was blowing in hard and knocked down two balls from Manny that would have been gone any other day. Saw the new William statue by Gate B. Pure schmaltz. He deserves better.
Yep, putting his hat on the little kitty's head, cute. And out of the side of his mouth, "Now get out of my way, you little rat bastard."
Hey, imagine what Steinbrenner's statue will be doing.
Cast in bronze, with his wallet out. The Rivalry, April 18th. The Yankees have never beaten the Red Sox in the World Series. With both teams in the American League, that, of course, is impossible. Nevertheless, the Yankees, who are playing the Red Sox in the third game of their first four-game set of 2004 as I write this, have become the Sox's principal rival over the last 50 or 60 years. And as someone who has written a great many scary stories during his career, I almost have to write about them. For Red Sox fans, the Yankees are the thing under the bed, the boogeyman in the closet. When they come to us, we expect bad luck on horseback. When we go to them, we expect in our hearts not to return alive. Footnote: in the first two meetings of this year, we beat them by scores of 6-2 and 5-2, and the Yankees' big off-season acquisition, Alex Rodriguez, who Red Sox fans see, rightly or wrongly, as a player stolen out from under our very noses by George "I'll spend anything" Steinbrenner, went 0-8. Well enough. In the third game, however, the team that will not die is leading the Sox 7-3 in the fourth inning. The rivalry has captured hearts in both Boston and New York, with fans cross-pollinating freely and sometimes fistily at the games. On April 16th, the New York Post's front page showed a pinstriped Darth Vader with a Yankees logo on his helmet and a bat on his shoulder. It quoted Red Sox president Larry Lucchino, who in 2002 called the Yankees the evil empire, and trumpeted, "May the curse be with you." On the Fox game of the week that night, of course it was the game of the week, are you kidding? The announcers displayed a souvenir t-shirt proclaiming, "Showdown in Beantown." That one must have been officially sanctioned by Red Sox management. In the bleachers, the ones reading "Jeter sucks" are much more popular. I understand that there's one featuring A-Rod with an even more obscene sentiment, but I haven't seen that one yet. I'm sure I will. And how many fightin' fans have been ejected by the security people over the years? I have no idea, but as old Casey used to say, you could look it up. When there are fights, the first blows are usually thrown by Red Sox fans. The jeers and epithets chiefly come from Sox fans, too. Maybe Billy Herman, who managed the club from 1964 to 1966, not stellar years, explained it best. For Red Sox fans, there are only two seasons, August and winter. Losing makes us sad, except when it doesn't. Then it makes us pissed. The attitude of your average pinstripe fan, on the other hand, unless and until directly attacked, tends to be one of indulgent, slightly patronizing good nature. Arguing with a Yankee fan is like arguing with a real estate agent who voted for Ronald Reagan. I date the Sox-Yanks rivalry of the modern age from October 3, 1948, a day on which the Red Sox actually beat the Yankees 10-5. What's wrong with that, you say? Well, it got us into a one-game playoff game with the Cleveland Indians. One we lost, 8-3. That's heartbreak number one. Fast forward past 1951. Mickey Mantle makes his major league debut versus the Red Sox. Yanks win 4-0. And 1952-53. The Red Sox lose 13 in a row to the Yankees. In 1956, Ted Williams fined for spitting at Boston fans after misplaying a Mickey Mantle fly ball, an incident Williams will never live down. Let us forget 1960, when the Yankees set the record for team home runs, 192, against Boston. and let us by all means wince past Roger Maris's 61st home run, which came against Tracy Stallard, who pitched for Boston. No, let's move directly to 1978. Nothing compares, says Dan Shaughnessy in The Curse of the Bambino. The mind calcifies. This was the apocalyptic, cataclysmic fold by which all others must be measured. Yeah, and it was pretty bad, too. On July 20th of that year, the Red Sox led the Yankees by 14 games. Footnote. Shaughnessy again. Only three collapses approximate this one. The 1915 Giants led the Boston Braves by 15 games on the 4th of July and finished 10.5 behind. The 1951 Brooklyn Dodgers led the Giants by 13 games August 11th, got tied on the final day of the season, then lost the playoff. And the 1964 Phillies led the Cardinals by 6.5 games, with 12 to play, then lost 10 straight. The Giants, Dodgers, and Phillies eventually won championships. The Red Sox, well, do we need to finish that? Fuck no. We's fans. Then came the infamous Boston Massacre, in which the Red Sox were swept, not at Yankee Stadium, but at Fenway, by the Bombers in a 4-game series. The Sox ended the season in a flat-footed tie with the Yankees and lost the playoff game in Monsieur Dent's punch and Bucky home run. The pop fly heard round the world. That's heartbreak number two. In 1999, the Red Sox went into postseason as the wildcard team and once again faced the Yankees. The Yanks won both of the first two games in the stadium, both by one run. They qualify as heartbreaks number 3A and 3B. Game one of this series, you may remember, was the one in which Chuck Knobloch dropped a throw from Scott Brosius. The ump then ruled he'd dropped the ball while transferring it from his glove to his hand. The third game, the first played at Fenway in the 99 series, offered some small measure of revenge. In that game, Sox batters pummeled first Roger Clemens and then a parade of relievers. Pedro Martinez fanned 12, and the Red Sox won 13-1. It was the most lopsided loss in the Yankees' postseason history. But in the end, it made no difference. You can't carry any of those runs over to later games, can you? In the following game, the Red Sox were victimized by another bad call, this time by Tim Tashita. Footnote. Who went to the unusual length of issuing an apology after the game. Fat lot of good it did us. And the Red Sox ended up losing 9-2. The Yankees won the final game 6-1. That's heartbreak number 3C. Whenever the eye of Red Sox management falls on a likely player, it seems that the eye of Steinbrenner, like the eye of Sauron in his tower, has also fallen there. It was very likely frustration as much as anything else that prompted Larry Lucchino's evil empire comment following the signing of Jose Contreras. Footnote. Who will not be eligible for the win today, I'm happy to report, in 2002. There was even more frustration following the signing of Alex Rodriguez. A-Rod was willing to come to Boston. It was the players' union that balked, citing a $15 million shortfall in Boston's offer and claiming it would set a disastrous precedent. Bullshit. Ball players are even more egregiously overpaid than best-selling novelists. The fans understand the truth. George Steinbrenner's your basic fat cat owner. His pockets are deeper because his fan base is deeper. Current capacity at Fenway is about 35,000. At Yankee Stadium, it's 58,000, and that's only the tip of the iceberg. The differences carry over to all the ancillary goodies, from T-shirts to the big casino. TV telecast rights. Hum, baby. And while you're at it, give me that cable deal, sweetheart. But enough dallying. We've reached heartbreak number 4, the one I've been putting off but can put off no longer. Worse than the Boston Massacre? Yes. Worse than the ground ball through Bill Buckner's wickets? Yes. Worse even than the Bucky Dent cheap home run? Yes, because more recent. The wound is fresher, still bleeding, in fact. Part of me just wants to say, if you don't know what happened, look it up or go rent a videotape somewhere. It hurts to even think about it, let alone write about it. Because, I think, we did more than come back. We were ahead. We were 5 outs away from beating the hated, feared Yankees in their own house in the American League Championship Series and going back to the World Series for the first time since 1986. We had our fingers around that puppy and it just slipped away. The smart money had the Yankees winning that series, but the Red Sox took the first and fourth games behind Tim Wakefield, who simply bamboozled the Yankee hitters with his knuckleball, and who would issue the final heartbreak in the 11th inning of Game 7. In between was the famous Game 3 rhubarb, more bad blood between two teams that have had it in for each other for what seems like 1,000 years. The trouble started when Pedro Martinez hit Kareem Garcia in the back, narrowly missing his head. After Garcia was forced at second, taking Red Sox second baseman Todd Walker out with an ugly spikes-up slide, Yankee catcher Jorge Posada yelled at Martinez from the dugout. Martinez reputedly responded in charming fashion. "I'll hit your head too, smartass," cried he. In frame number 4, Roger Clemens, never a gentleman, threw at Manny Ramirez, who responded by telling the Rocket he could go fuck himself. Roger responded by telling Manny that no, Manny could go fuck himself. A real meeting of the minds, you see. The benches erupted. Don Zimmer, the aging Yankee coach, footnote, when Zim was the Red Sox field general, Sox pitcher Bill Lee once called him the designated gerbil, ended up rolling around on the ground courtesy of Pedro Martinez. Later, Zim made a tearful apology, behavior that cost fellow New Englander Edmund Muskie his shot at the presidency. But maybe that's neither here nor there. In any case, the Yankees won the game. They also won Game 5 behind David, Bostonians or Psycho, Wells. The 2003 ALCS returned to Yankee Stadium with the Bronx Bombers needing only one more win to go on to the World Series. But the Sox won ugly in Game 6, 9-6. So, Game 7. The Red Sox got off to a 4-0 lead behind Pedro, the ace of the staff. Jason Giambi then hit a pair of solo home runs for the Yanks. David Ortiz hit one for the Sox. It was 5-2 Red Sox in the 8th inning. Mayor Rudy Giuliani thought the Red Sox were finally going to win it. Footnote: Red Sox versus Yankees, the great rivalry. Harvey Fromer and Frederick J. Fromer, Sports Publishing, Boston Baseball, 2004. This is a Boston-biased book, but most of the color photographs show celebrating Yankees and downcast Red Sox. Wonder why? Martinez got the first batter, Nick Johnson, he faced in that inning, and the Red Sox were 5 outs away from the World Series. For we Red Sox fans, that was the 2003 equivalent of Pickett's charge, as close as we ever got. Jeter the horrible to Sox fans, double to right. Bernie Williams singled, driving in Jeter. Matsui hit a ground rule double after Grady conferred with the tiring but game Martinez and decided to leave him in. Hell, it had worked once or twice during the regular season, and still left him in to face Posada, who dumped one over second base to tie the game. The Red Sox manager finally came with the hook, but Red Sox Nation would pretty much agree it was too little, too late. In the bottom of the 11th inning, Mayor Giuliani told his wife and daughter, "You're going to see your first walk-off home run." Footnote: Ibid. The batter was Aaron Boone, and he made the mayor a prophet. Tim Wakefield, the man who was arguably the most responsible for getting the Red Sox as far as they were able to go, served up the fatal pitch, but had nothing to hang his head about. The real damage was done with one out in the 8th. And is there a reason to drag all this history into a book about the 2004 Red Sox? There sure is. More than one, actually. First, Baseball is a game of history, and those who don't learn from it are condemned to get drubbed by it. Second, even in a much-improved American League East, the Yankees and Red Sox still seem, at this point in the young season, like the two dominant teams. Footnote: the Yankees won today's game 7-3. The final game of the series will be played tomorrow at 11 a.m. It's the annual Patriots Day game in Boston. And with today's win and tomorrow's matchup, Boston's Bronson Arroyo versus the Yankees' Kevin Brown, the Yankees have an excellent chance of earning a split. Curse them. The tradition and history will hang over each of these matches like grandstand shadows over the infield at 5 o'clock. The Red Sox half of the tradition, unfortunately, is one of losing the big games. The history half is one of snatching defeat from the jaws of victory, as on the night of October 17, 2003. Looking the other way into the future, into the outfield where the shadows have not yet reached, if you will, is the simple fact that the landscape of the American League East has changed since 2003. Even 2 weeks into the season, that seems apparent. The lowly Tampa Bay Devil Rays, the previously lowly D-Rays, are at 500, and the previously lowly Baltimore Orioles are in first place. Those things will likely change, but I think it's likely that the Blue Jays also improved, won't finish 30 games below 500, as they would if they continued along at their current pace. What all this means to the Sox-Yanks rivalry is that one team is apt to be called when the postseason bell rings, but probably not both. And that makes the knees of every Red Sox fan tremble, no matter what they may tell you, no matter what sentiments they wear on their T-shirts, no matter what vile canards they may call down upon Yankee outfielders from the monster seats high above. There is no calculus here. The math is simple. We all hate what we fear, and sensible Red Sox fans fear the Yankees. Now, on the 18th of April, the Red Sox lead the 19-game regular season series 2-1. A great many other games will be played with a great many other clubs before the dust settles and the 2004 season is in the record books. But in my heart, I believe the American League East will come down to them or to us. And because we fear what we hate, in my heart, I always dread it when they come to us. The only thing I dread more is when we must go to them. I suppose it would be different if I could play, but of course I can't. I'm helpless, doomed to only watch. To believe in the curse of the Bambino, even though I don't believe in it. And to think of the late Stephen Jay Gould, who somehow rooted for both teams. Maybe in the end that was what killed him, not the cancer. And who once said, "The deepest possible anguish is running a long, hard course again and again to the very end, and then self-destructing 1 inch from the finish line." Postscript, April 19th. This is Patriots Day, which is a holiday only in Maine, where it chiefly means no mail delivery, and Massachusetts, where it means the Boston Marathon and an 11 o'clock Red Sox game at Fenway. Today, the Red Sox spotted the Yankees' leads of 3-0 and 4-1, but Bronson Arroyo settled down and pitched a good game in ESPN Sports Center Argo, and the Red Sox won it by a final score of 5-4. Footnote: the loser, I'm very sorry to say, happened to be ex-Red Sox closer Tom Gordon, the star of a book I wrote, and in The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon, Flash will be the Red Sox closer forever. Sorry, Mr. Steinbrenner, but there's not a thing you can do about that one. I'm happy to report that A-Rod's woes continue. He went 1-for-17 in the 4-game series. Hee-hee. The one hit was a meaningless single. And he made a throwing error in today's tilt that basically cost the Yankees the game. So now we're 3-1 with the Yanks and can get back to the more normal business of playing baseball. Whew.
April 20th. I read in the paper that in his first home game, Dauber hit 2 homers, leading the Paw Sox to a 3-2 victory over Rochester. And to replace Frank Castillo, the Red Sox have activated lefty Lenny DiNardo, giving us 4 lefties in the pen for the first time I can remember. Must be setting up for this weekend series in the Bronx, that short porch and right. I hope these Paw Sox can get it done. I'd start resting Embry now. The crowd in the Sky Dome tonight is around 6,000, despite the Pedro Halliday rematch. The Maple Leafs are playing the Ottawa Senators in Game 7 of their playoff series, and at one point, Eric Fried, Nesson's new man in the stands, says there are more people in the concourse watching hockey than there are in the seats. Oh, Canada. Pedro throws well and we win easily, but there's a little bad blood in the ninth when reliever Terry Adams goes up and in on Manny. Manny ducks away, tossing his helmet aside, and stands squared with the mound, arms out, calling, "What do you want?" Earlier, reliever Valerio de los Santos knocked Ortiz on his ass with a pitch aimed at his face, so it's not an overreaction on Manny's part, as Jerry claims. When their no-name pitchers throw at your big three and four guys, it's on. The bench is clear, and while there are no punches thrown, it's a signal that we're not going to take that shit. Expect newbie Lenny DiNardo to dust someone like Delgado tomorrow, or Timlin to plunk Wells or Phelps. I get an email from Steve.
Petey looked a lot better than Doc, didn't he? Are the Yankees playing tonight? I tried to get him on the satellite, and they were playing some weepy old Thurman Munson short instead of the Chi Sox. Red Sox win, Martinez goes 2-1. Time for Tom Caron and Bob Tewksbury, a.k.a. the talking board.
Rain delay. The Yanks scored 7 in the first, so maybe that'll get erased. Tewks, you'll notice he changed his hair from that 50s style to something from the mid to late 70s. And where the hell is Bob Rogers? Do they have him in a cage under Car Talk Plaza?
I think I'll Google the sumbitch.
Google away, dude, but I think Carmen Sandiego is working him over in a dank room with a diehard and some piano wire. Long live TC and the new man in the stands, who looks like Ross Perot's love child.
According to the Globe, March 2, 2004, Rogers left Fort Myers to coach a Whitman-Hanson boys basketball game in the MIAA tournament. He left a recorded sports desk segment but did not get permission to do this. Both Nesson and Red Sox management weren't happy. And although the public word is that Bobby the serial killer has left Nesson to pursue other opportunities, Sean McGrail, the fact is they canned his ass. According to Globe writer Bill Griffith, Red Sox management has sent a message that there are new sheriffs in town. In a totally unrelated development, you should know that ex-Red Soxer Mo Vaughn is going to be the Grand Marshal of the 15th Annual Hot Dog Safari on May 16th at Suffolk Downs. It's being billed the Hit Dog and the Hot Dog. How the mighty have fallen. By the way, Stu, Google also reports that a Bob Rogers is reffing college soccer in the Boston area, but that may not be the same one.
So he's just out there somewhere, like Michael Myers.
Dude, that's it. Or Jason, only with a wimp mask, sorta.
April 21st. A package arrives from the souvenir store, which is in fact Twins Enterprises now. The Sox have made it their official store, with the glossy 2004 yearbook, a blue windbreaker made in Korea, and a t-shirt made in Uzbekistan. Now I'm outfitted for the summer. The yearbook must have been put to bed in late March, because they are sharing the same page are Shump and Tony Woe. UPS brings another present, a rough cut of a future episode of Kingdom Hospital called Butterfingers. The storyline is familiar to Sox fans. Earl Candleton, the first baseman for the long-suffering New England Robins, drops a pop-up that would have won them the 87 World Series. From then on, he's hounded by fans who call him Butterfingers and pelt him with balls. He descends into alcoholism, living in a flea bag of a mission in Lewiston. When the Robins go to Game 7 of the series, with the game on the line in the bottom of the ninth, Earl holds a revolver to his temple. If the Robins win, he lives. If they fold, he dies. Of course, they fold, and he pulls the trigger and drops into a cobwebby purgatory as the doctors and kinder spirits of Kingdom Hospital try to save him. The effects haven't been matted in yet, so there are scenes where Grip follows the waif ghost Mary around with the head of the benevolent beast Antibus on a stick. In the end, the spirits, with the help of Peter, the artist, in a car crash-induced coma, allow Earl to go back to that moment in 87 and make the catch, changing himself and the world. The two Down syndrome dishwashers who serve as oracles have the last word. Baseball's not always a sad game. Sometimes the good guys win. Tonight the matchup is Wake versus Ted Lilly, who beat us on opening day. Wake sharp, and Doug Mirabelli, happy to be starting, wallops two homers to give us a 3-0 lead, but the Jays chip away. I get an email from Steve.
3-2 in the sixth. This is turning into a nail-biter. Damn, I hate seeing all those 250 hitters in the lineup. Thank God for Douglas Miracle Mirabelli. Speaking of hockey, did you see his shot off the glass?
Doug also came through big time Friday night against the Yanks. Amazing that he can be this hot when he sits 4 days between starts. And Tech's hot, too. But Pokey, oh my, he's just struggling. It's still 3-2 in the eighth when Tosca brings in Valerio De Los Santos once more to face David Ortiz. Last night, De Los Santos put David on his ass. Tonight, he hangs a breaking ball that David stings down the right field line. It bounces fair and caroms off the stands, right to the right fielder Reed Johnson, and David has to sprint for second. He's a big man and looks silly running way up on his toes, arms pumping. He slides headfirst, bouncing off the dirt, and he's in there. We shouldn't laugh, but can't help it. Part of it is how sweet his revenge is. De Los Santos is scowling as Tosca comes to take the ball from him. David hustles over to third on a long sack fly by Manny. Only a great leaping catch against the wall by Johnson saves extra bases. Then, on a wild pitch, scoots for home, sliding feet first this time, safe, adding an earned run to De Los Santos' stats. The camera finds him brooding in the dugout. We win 4-2. After the post-game show, Steve and I are still debating hope and fatalism. I think it's neat how our attitudes are so different. After 86, last year didn't feel that drastic to me. I mean, sure, it hurt, but I'd been through worse. And we weren't even supposed to get that far. We were at least 3 players away. So I thought everything after Trott's shot was gravy and just dug the ride. This year I have higher hopes because of Schilling and Folk. And here's some history. The Angels, prior to 2001, were all-time chokers, remember? No, you can't, at least not emotionally. Because their win has forever changed the way we see the club and its past. It's a line you cross, and when the Sox cross it, our hindsight will be softened, and all these close calls will lose their power to wound us. Like the Pats will no longer be hapless. Ask the old hard luck Yukon Huskies of Jim Calhoun, the 1980 Phillies, the last two Elway Bronco squads, etc., etc. So goodbye, Tony Easton. Goodbye, Donnie Moore.
Donnie Moore. Now there's a horror story. I've been thinking about this, and I've decided that the age difference makes a difference here. What is it, 14 years between us? Which means I remember Williams and you don't. I remember Maz leaping joyously around the bases when he hit that home run, and you've only seen the kinescopes. I'm not trying to pull rank or make you feel like a kid. I'm just trying to get a focus on how we can approach this so differently. Maybe I've got it. I've been suffering 14 more years. Why, that's almost a generation.
I see it as partly geographical, that winning Pittsburgh experience. But part of it's also that I waited for both the Oakland Raiders and New York Rangers to finally win their championships after years and years of their great and heavily favored teams choking, and for two truly hapless clubs, the Pats and Penguins, to win theirs, only to have lightning strike not once but twice. All four of these teams put a shitload of history behind them with one big cleansing win. And that's what the Sox will do, too.
But don't you see, your very argument proves what a striking anomaly the Red Sox are. All the clubs you've mentioned, in all the various sports, in this and in previous emails, have won it all at least once in the last 80 or so years. Do I need to finish this thought? I mean, hello. One of these things is not like the others. One of these things just doesn't belong. One of these things is not like the others. Tell me while I sing this song.
By the same token, all of these teams were in our strikingly anomalous position, which we share with the Cubs, White Sox, Brewers, Mariners, Astros, Rangers, D-Rays, Padres, Expos, Rockies, not to mention dozens of NFL clubs. The St. Louis, Arizona Cards have never won one, or the Saints, or the Bills, the Mini Vikes, etc., etc. Dozens of NBA and NHL franchises. whole boatloads of NCAA Division I schools, etc. Up until T equals plus zero, when all their troubled histories were redeemed by the one resource the world can count on, time. It's inevitable. Maybe not in our lifetimes, but that just means our faith has to be strong. Which is one reason why I dug Butterfinger so much. How you framed Earl Candleton's life and error in terms of salvation or damnation. Take me out to the ball game, shall we gather at the river? Hail Mary, Mother of Grace, I thought I was in hell. You really made us feel for the guy. So when the dishwashing kids came out after you'd used the old rewind to redeem number 11 and said, sometimes the good guys win, damned if I didn't get a little teary for Billy Buck and for all of us. And Billy Buck, you know, we don't blame you. It was that lousy Schiraldi.
I think Schiraldi might have been in some form of analysis or therapy following that season. I'm almost sure of this. And he was my daughter's first crush, a young man and fair.
He should have gone into analysis before the Angels series. And McNamara should have had his head examined for using him in both. I guess some young girls just dig troubled guys.
Brewers, Mariners, Astros, Rangers, D-Rays, Padres, Expos, Rockies. Johnny-come-latelys. But Pokey, oh my, he's just struggling. Yeah, but he's a PR master.
I'll cop to the Rocks and Rays being latecomers. But the Pods and Spos are looking at 30-plus years of futility, the Stros at 40-plus. And the Rangers, as the Senators, have to go back to 1924 for their sole crown, compared to our five during that era. You know, I just flat-out like Pokey, despite him hitting 182, 67 points higher than Ellis Burks. He's got a major league glove, and we haven't seen much of that over the years.
So do I. You just can't not like him, can you? And he's been steady Eddie with the glove.
April 22nd. The Yanks won, but the O's lost. So guess who's all alone in first? So far, Doug Mirabelli has 3 homers and 9 at-bats. He sees his success as a product of his extra preparation. Playing once every 5 days, I can put all my focus into that pitcher and watch video or whatever for 4 days and try to get a little edge for myself to feel confident going in there. Which at least partially explains why over his career he's a 270 hitter as a Sox and 213 as a Giant and Ranger. The matchup tonight is in our favor again. Schilling Batista. And the game goes as planned early on. Ortiz hits a 2-run shot in the first, and we hang on through 6 when Toronto goes to their pen. Francona said that he'll close with Williamson instead of Fulk, who's thrown 3 straight days now. And maybe he's worried about conserving the pen for this weekend in New York, because he leaves Schilling in too long in the 7th, and the Jays tie the game with 4 straight hits. Take him out, we're screaming at the set. In the 8th, Schilling comes back out. We just look at each other. Would Francona have done this at Fenway? Mystery Malaska's the only one warming as the Jays load the bases. Schilling's pitch count's above 120, and he's consistently leaving the ball up. Number 9 hitter Chris Gomez makes the decision for Francona, hooking a grand slam over the left field fence, and Toronto wins their first home game, 7-3. Put this one on the list of games we should have won. When Schill struggles in the 7th, go to a stopper like Embry, then use any of your setup guys in the 8th and close with Williamson. What's the point of carrying extra arms if you don't use them? At least the Yankees lost. The Chi Sox got to Moose early and hung on 4-3. It's slight consolation. I'm so disgusted I don't even watch the post-game, just turn the channel, as if I can make the loss go away. I email Steve. Captain, I'm detecting high levels of gradium.
Boy, you got that right.
April 23rd. The O's beat the D-Rays, so they're in first again. The Current's all excited about the Sox-Yanks rivalry. Because Hartford's halfway between the two cities, the paper has a beat writer for both teams. The Yankee guy's a total homer, while the Red Sox guy, as befits the tradition, is a skeptic. Both dwell on Aaron Boone and Game 7, as if that's the only thing that happened last year. We're headed down to New York to spend the weekend with Trudy's parents before they leave from the West Side Piers for the transatlantic cruise they've always talked about. Trudy's sister and her boys will be there. We'll go to a few museums, take in a show, wander around Chinatown. But one thing we won't be doing is going to the games.
Tonight, it's Red Sox-Yankees, Round 2, Game 1. So far, the advantage goes to the Red Sox. They're up 6-0 in the fifth inning, courtesy of home runs by Millar, Bellhorn, and a three-run job by Bill Miller. Do I need to bother with all this in-game detail? Probably not. Onan will have it. In fact, I'm starting to suspect that Onan is going to finish the season with roughly 700 pages of manuscript. That man takes his baseball seriously. The question I've been asking myself is whether or not I need to bother with a diary at all. I can hear my mother asking me, "Do you have to jump in the lake just because Stuart Onan does?" No, Ma. And certainly I don't expect to be scrivening away at this on every game day. But it seems to me that I do have to add something from time to time, call it a kind of balance. Stewart's the brains of the operation, no doubt. He knows where all the fielders are playing at any given time, and who'll be covering second, Bellhorn or Reese, Garcia Parra soon, if God is good, in any given situation. I'm more of a from-the-gut guy. Also a superstitious guy. I don't necessarily know where the fielders are, but I do know enough to hit the mute button on the remote control when the opposing team's up, because everyone knows it's unlucky to listen to the announcers when the opposing team's at bat. They always score when fans do that. You should know that I'll be doing the mute thing for the Sox all season long, so relax. I'll also be turning my cap around when we're a run or two down in the late innings, and charting pitches when the opposing guy is really good. It's a hell of a jinx. I got Moose Mussina that way, and expect to get Victor Zambrano, Devil Rays ace, currently 3-1, in the same fashion when he pitches against us. And okay, quite often when the Red Sox are only up by a run or so in the late innings, I simply turn the idiot box off for a few minutes. Every superstitious fan knows that not watching for a while can also be good mojo. But basically I do it because I'm too scared to watch, especially if there are men from the opposing team on base. I made it through Night of the Living Dead and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but baseball, especially stretch-run baseball, shreds my nerves. Now, though, it's 6-0 Red Sox in the fifth, and Derek Lowe doesn't look too bad. Don't worry, I knocked on wood when I said it. Oh, yeah, and when Alex Rodriguez grounded out weakly, pitcher to first in the fourth, the disgruntled fans in Yankee Stadium actually booed their preseason darling. Music to my ears. I'm also an emotional guy, at least when it comes to the game. There's really nothing like baseball, especially when you don't have to freeze your ass off on a cold, rainy night in the Bronx. And a postscript. Today, the New York Post had fun comparing Johnny Damon, with his new beard and extra long hair, to a Cro-Magnon caveman. Johnny just scored Boston's 7th run of the night.
We take the Cross Bronx, driving by the Yankee Stadium exit right around game time. I don't turn on the radio. I'll let this one be a surprise, like opening a present or a door, the lady or the tiger. There's so much chatter in New York, I figure I'll pick up bits of the game on the street, like a pulse underwriting the city. Our first hint is in the hotel bar, where I notice Steph is bravely wearing his wake shirt. As we pass the bar, a TV tells us it's 6-0, but I'm not sure in whose favor. I see Billy Miller make a nice off-balance throw to close an inning, and Lowe making a fist, so I'm hopeful. We're sitting so far in the dark back of the lounge that we can't see the TV, but when we come back out, it's 6-0 Sox, and Donovan Osborne's in for the Yanks. We make some noise, attracting the attention of a drunk Mets fan. "Red Sox, huh? All I gotta say is Bill Buckner, okay? Bill Buckner." "I hope you guys have a better year this year," I say. Downstairs, the doorman shaking his head at how bad the Yanks have been so far. "They'll be all right," he says. "George will pay." A billboard for an investment firm in Times Square says, "Brave as a Red Sox fan in the Bronx." But all around me, I'm seeing people in Sox caps and shirts laughing and giving each other the thumbs up, something I've never experienced before in New York. We're finishing dinner when Trudy's sister and her boys arrive with a new score, 10-2. The two were on a homer by Matsui, their only clutch guy.
We stop at a liquor store on the way back to the hotel for some champagne, and I can't resist asking the guy behind the counter in a Yanks hat who's winning the game. I get an email from Steve.
As I write this, it's 11-2 in the eighth, and the only reason it isn't 11-0 is because Derek got a little tired there. I think we're going to go up on him 4-1, which would be very Swede, knock on wood. Uh-oh. Who's Lenny DiNardo? Still worrying, even with one out. Red Sox win 11-2, and Eckersley's on extra innings. Whee!
Down in the city, I don't get Eck. But at 1 a.m, I do get WCBS replaying the entire game. So here I am, half-buzzed and headachy from champagne, watching a game that's already long over in a darkened hotel room while everyone else sleeps, just for the sheer pleasure of seeing how we did it. Bill Miller with a 3-run shot, and basically they didn't throw a quality pitcher at us all night. Looks like Torrey wrote this one off, knowing he's got the matchup tomorrow, and hoping Vasquez can get Sunday's game to the pen. April 24th. In the hotel, as I'm getting on the elevator to go down to Times Square, a woman in a Sox hat and shirt gets out, obviously going to today's game. And in the Guggenheim, as I wind my way down, I pass two boys in Sox hats, and their dad wearing a cherry red Cowboy Up t-shirt. In the taxi on the way to Chinatown, the radio's on low, but I can still hear that the Sox are up 2-1. Go ahead, Bronson. Named, yes, after Charles Bronson. Hours later, back at the hotel, two decked-out Jets fans get on the elevator. I'd completely forgotten that today's the NFL draft. I've been seeing lots of Pat's hats, but I just expect that now. It's almost 5 when we get back to the room. The game should be over, so I pop on the TV for the score. It's an extra innings, 2-2, and Falk's on. There are two down in the 11th, and Sheffield's on first. I'm supposed to get dressed for dinner in the theater tonight, then jump a cab out to the airport to pick up Caitlin, and time's tight. But I sit on the edge of the bed with the boys and watch Tech gun down Chef trying to get in scoring position for Bernie, with a nice slap tag by Crespo at second. In the top of the 12th, Manny doubles to the base of the wall in right center. Tech fights off 3 or 4 outside pitches from Quantrill before he gets one he can pull to the right side, moving Manny over with a ground out. Quantrill just nicks Millar's shirt front with a pitch, and the double play's in order, but Bellhorn drives one medium deep to center, and Bernie with his weak arm has been playing in and has to go back to get it. Manny scores easily. 3-2 Sox. Timlin comes on to close, but we've got to go. We call up from the lobby because we've forgotten Caitlin's flight information, and there are 2 outs, nobody on, and a 1-2 count on Jeter. And then in the cab, we hear that the Yanks have just lost to the Sox. This is the kind of demoralizing game we've already lost 2 of to Baltimore, and it's sweet to win one, especially in someone else's house. It's even sweeter because we're in New York, as if the city's ours now. The local news at 11 has found a way to soften the blow. They open the sports with a long segment on the Giants trading for #1 pick Eli Manning, then show A-Rod making a nice backhand and getting Millar. Then A-Rod homering before showing Bellhorn's sack fly in the final score. The homer was the only hit Bronson Arroyo gave up in 6 innings, but you never know that.
Holy moly, the Bo Sox did it again. It took them 12 innings today, but they beat the Yankees 3-2. Keith Falk got the win in relief. Vultured the win is the term baseball players use for this type of win, I believe. Timlin pitched the bottom of the 12th and got the save. If it were possible to feel sorry for the Yankees, who are now 4 full games out of first place, although whether behind us or Baltimore, I don't at this moment know, I would feel almost sorry for them. Life being what it is, I don't feel a bit sorry. Derek Jeter, known in my household as Great Satan Jeter, is now 0 for his last 1,000 or so. The fans don't boo him, though. Jeter seems truly beyond the boo birds. But the Yankees, man, I mean, how long can you go on saying, don't worry, it's only April? Another 6 days, actually. Meanwhile, we're throwing Pedro at them tomorrow and going for the sweep. We're only 5 wins away from taking the series. That's the series for the year. Man, I can't believe this. Something's gotta go wrong. Unless dead or insane, I will be writing about tomorrow's game. April 25th. It's the last game of round two with the Bo Sox going for the sweep over the Yankees. In the top of the first inning, the young Yankee pitcher, Javier Vasquez, looked terrific, determined to be the stopper. Ortiz touched him for a single, but that was it. Now Pedro Martinez is on the mound for us, and the real question is which Pedro is going to show up, the mound-wise Sharpie who pitched in Toronto last time, or the mediocre rag arm who started the season against Baltimore at Camden Yards and then left the park early, sparking a minor media flurry. He's 3-2 to Jeter to start with. Jeter, 0 for his last 21, strikes out to make that 0 for his last 22. It's the worst streak of Jeter's career, and given that sort of funk, tells us very little about the state of Pedro. But even as I write the words, there goes Bernie Williams, 3-1. That looks a little better, and has silenced the massive chant, another sellout today at the stadium, of Pedro sucks. And Kevin Millar just made an incredible sliding catch on A-Rod to finish the first. No runs and no runners for the Yankees. The Yanks are, I should add, something of an anomaly, the only team against which I actively root. It was true for a while of Cleveland in the early 90s, but no more. And it seems to me that the Yankees almost have to have this third game, not to keep from falling five games off the pace early, although five really is quite a few at any point in the season, but because it's the hated Red Sox, and they are at home. In the third inning, the story still seems to be young Vasquez, who gets six of the first nine outs by way of the K. Then in the top of the fourth, Mark Bellhorn, batting today in the two-hole, walks, because that's what Mark Bellhorn does. After Ortiz strikes out looking, number seven for Vasquez, Manny Ramirez comes up. After getting ahead of Manny 0-2, Vasquez attempts to waste a curveball. He wastes it out over the plate, and see ya, over the Yankee bullpen and into the bleacher zone. We're up 2-0 in the middle innings. Bottom of the fifth, Yankees threatening with runners on second and third, two out, and Jeter, 0-23 at the plate. Takes call strike one, outside corner. Chases a fastball way up and out of the zone for strike two. Pedro sets, fires, teases Jeter outside. 1-2. Pedro's ready to go again, but Jeter steps out, commanding right hand up to the ump in the old familiar gesture. Now he's back in, and Pedro immediately strikes him out looking with high, hard cheese. Jeter is 0-24, and the Yankees once more fail with two in scoring position before Jeter, Enrique Wilson, who usually beats Pedro like a drum, popped out to Pokey. Sweet. In the sixth, A-Rod doubles with one out and goes to third on a Giambi groundout. Cesar Crespo in short right field, an almost comical overshift, makes the play on Giambi. Rodriguez, at least, has begun to come around. His average has crept up to something like 252, but it does the Yankees no good. Gary Sheffield fouls out to Veritek, and it's still 2-0 Sox going into the lates. Pedro's done after seven. His game to win, the bullpen's to lose. The bullpen hasn't given up a run in 20-some innings, but now Williamson's on, and he's a scary guy. Here's Jeter again. He tries to bunt, no joy. Fouls one away, and it's 0-2, a place Derek has gotten all too familiar with just lately. Let's see how Williamson plays this. He throws a low fastball, a true waste pitch, but Jeter goes fishing and strikes out. This time the crowd does boo, and even the resolutely upbeat Yankee announcers finally take notice. Like booing Santa Claus, one of them remarks reprovingly. It's the bottom of the ninth and last call for the Yankees. Here's Alex Rodriguez, and it's still Williamson to face him. No Keith Falk, a little surprising. Williamson runs the count full on A-Rod, who has seven of the last 22 Yankee hits. So much for that slump. Rodriguez, after fouling off one 3-2 pitch, grounds out third to first, Now Jason Giambi grounds to Pokey Reese, two out. Here's Gary Sheffield, who has one of the Yankees' four hits today. This time he strikes out, and suddenly, incredibly, the Red Sox have taken 6 of 7 from the AL champs. The camera sneaks a look into their dugout, and the look on Jeter's face is one of pure amazement, and it's justified. This is the first time the Red Sox have beaten the Yankees 6 out of the first 7 since 1913. Sweet. I email Stewart. I saw all the games and got 6 pages on the sweep in my newly inaugurated Sox diary. Gloat, gloat. What it boils down to for the Yankees is that if they don't start playing pretty soon, it's gonna get late early and be lights out in August. Remember when I said I like them for third place?
Gloating is such an ugly word for this creamy and delicious feeling. I think the Yanks' swoon will just make George bust out the wallet earlier for a starter or two. Lieber's still a ways away from filling the 5 slot, and Contreras looks terrible. Using Vasquez on 3 days' rest, even though he threw well, is a desperate move on old Joe's part. And after the day off tomorrow, they got to face the A's 3 big aces. Who's going to throw that Thursday game? Vasquez on 3 days again? They're screwed. We trusted Bronson with the ball twice against them, and he came through. And BK's not far from being ready. Your third-place pick looks entirely possible. As expected, we're getting quality starts and our pens much better, and those O's are pounding the ball. The Yanks right now are suffering from the revenge of Pettit, Clem Boy, and Boomer. April 26th. Tonight's the premiere of the Red Sox movie Still We Believe. Alyssa, my former student, has lined up a press pass for me. And while I've put together a short list of questions and fitted fresh batteries in the mini cassette recorder, I've still got mixed feelings about crossing the line between fan and journalist. We get to the Lowe's on the Common right on time, check in at the press table, and claim a spot behind the velvet rope next to the red carpet. I've never had a press pass before, and I have no idea what secret powers it gives me. Outside, WEEI is doing a live feed from the street. It's raining and cold out, and the crowd's thin. As more people filter in, we're boxed and jostled by TV cameras. Nesson's well represented. ESPN2, NECN, all the Boston channels. Nothing's happening, but there's some serious jockeying for position. Johnny Damon and Kevin Millar are definites, but those are the only two names mentioned. I'm hoping for Eck, maybe Yaz, Tim Wakefield, Pokey Reese. Wally, the green monster, shows up in a tux, mugging for the cameras. Hey, Wally, who are you wearing? The fans featured in the film arrive, and the cameramen blind them with their lights. The sports anchors do their stand-ups. I'm not really interested in the fan stars. I know I'll get their stories from the movie anyway. Tom Caron stops at the press table, and Dan Shaughnessy. Big Sam Horn signs a ball for me, something a real journalist would never, ever ask him to do. And there's Tom Werner and John Henry and Larry Lucchino and Louis Tiant. Everyone but the players. Outside, rented searchlights twirl across the night sky. It's nearly showtime when Kevin Millar arrives in a vintage Western print shirt, jeans, and shiny black cowboy boots. He smiles as he shakes hands and signs, doing stand-up after stand-up as he inches down the red carpet. I bypass the clot of reporters and set up at an open spot a little farther down. I catch him just as he's bouncing out. He's trailed by a guy my age, dressed head to toe in Sox paraphernalia, with his huge naked beer gut bulging out and painted with the Red Sox logo and Still We Believe. WEEI has judged him the most outrageous fan and given him a ticket to the show. He shakes Millar's hand, pleased to meet him. Kevin, I say. And he talks to me just because I've got this recorder. It has power like a gun. What were you like as a fan when you were younger? Like this guy. You're kind of the official fan of the Sox with the cowboy up, but who is your team? Dodgers. Grew up in Los Angeles. Dodgers were my team. Favorite player? Steve Garvey. You wear the jersey? Never had a jersey, but I was a big fan of the Dodgers. I'd go to a lot of games. Listen a lot on the radio? Vin Scully. Ever get the autographs? Went and got the autographs, did it all. Are you still a fan now? Can you be a fan now that you're a player?
No doubt about it. Are you still a Dodger fan? Still a Dodger fan, still a fan of baseball. You check their box score every morning? No, I don't check them, but I pull for them when I see them. So you hope to see him this fall? That'd be nice. And that's it. I thank him and he's gone to the next mic, the next camera. I've definitely crossed the line with my impersonation of a journalist. But as a fan, it's my duty to take advantage of whatever access I can get, for the sheer thrill of it. Johnny Damon's not here yet, but they're going to start the movie, so we crowd into the theater with Kevin Millar and the owners and everyone else. Down front, a radio team introduces all the Sox VIPs who stand in turn to receive their applause. When they call Johnny Damon's name, Big Sam stands up as a joke. Finally, the filmmaker, Paul Doyle, thanks everyone who helped and says, "The fans are the Red Sox," a sentiment which seems true even before he presents his evidence. When I was talking to a real journalist earlier, I mentioned that I've only been a Sox fan for 25 years, so I'm new. I was here before Clemens, and I'll be here long after Pedro. I've got a no-cut contract. Steve's in the film, briefly, a shot of him chatting with John Henry before the ill-fated season opener in Tampa Bay. That was the one Chad Fox blew. And while the movie doesn't have the time to tell the rest of the story, after we dumped Fox, he went on, along with former Sox closer Oogie Urbina, to defeat the Yanks and become a world champion. In trying to squeeze the whole season and eight very different fans' lives into 2 hours, the film can't connect all the dots. What strikes me most are all the Sox from last year's squad who are gone. Shea Hillenbrand, Todd Walker, Brandon Lyon, Damian Jackson, John Burkett, Jeff Supon, Scott Sauerbeck, and of course manager Grady Little, who, since we're in a room with the people who fired him, gets laughed at more than I find necessary. We witness Theo informing our number one prospect, Freddy Sanchez, that he's being traded to Pittsburgh for Supon and Sauerbeck, neither of whom panned out. The main tension and source of comedy in the movie is the tug of war between hope and pessimism. Angry Bill, a diehard who's become a fixture on local call-in shows, vows that he'll never believe in the Sox again and sees disaster everywhere until we take the A's. Fireman Steve Craven is more laid back. "We'll get him tomorrow," he says, and caps the film after the disaster of Game 7 with his observation that all the losing will make finally winning it all that much sweeter. Don't you think? It's a fun film, but there's so much missing. Where's Bill James and his ridiculous bullpen by committee idea? Where's BK giving us the finger? Where's Rogers' last win in Fenway? Where's Todd Walker's two-out, two-strike shot against Baltimore? Even the intricacies of the playoff games are glossed over, so while it gets some of the emotion of being a Sox fan, it still just skims the surface. And being a Sox fan is about total immersion. The after-party at Felt is crowded and loud, but there's free Sam Adams, good hors d'oeuvres, and for the brave, Fenway Frank served out of actual vendor steamers. Beside us, Louis Tiant is chowing down. I want to talk to Larry Lucchino, maybe interview him about growing up as a Pirates fan in Pittsburgh, but he's lost in the crowd. And then when I see him, he's on his way out. We've got to get going, too. Tomorrow's a school day. It's raining like hell, and we've got a long drive. On the way home, Trudy says she was disappointed that only Kevin Millar showed. I am too, but big props to Mr. Millar, who did it all cheerfully. In his business, a night off's a cherished rarity. I know I get on him for his lack of speed in the outfield, but as with that difficult assignment, tonight he stepped up when no one else did. April 27th. Ellis Burke's knee is hurting him, and his 133 batting average is hurting us, so he's on the DL, and the Dobbers coming up from Pawtucket. In 10 games there, he hit 350 with 5 homers and 11 RBIs, including a walk-off shot. In baseball, you've got to keep plugging. Until forever, I guess. Is there any wonder why we love this guy? A strange front must be moving over New England because it's been sunny all day here. But up in Boston, it's pouring. To cheer us up during the rain delay, Nesson shows clips of Nomar and BK working out at Fenway earlier today. Nomar's in shorts, taking grounders at half speed, and then talking with Mia Hamm over the low wall along third. BK's also in shorts, playing catch in the outfield grass. You think of him as this whip of a kid, but his thighs are massive and cut like early Arnold. Don and Jerry make it sound like he'll be our number five guy, and Arroyo will go to the pen. A good hour and a half after game time, the Sox call it. April 28th. The team so excited about BK's rehab that he's going to skip his last minor league start and pitch the first game of tomorrow's day-night doubleheader. Schilling will still go tonight, and Lowe tomorrow night, meaning Wake is sacrificing his start, something he's done throughout his long tenure with us, unselfish of him and extremely valuable, giving his manager more flexibility. Though he's running and taking infield, the team says Nomar's still at least 2 weeks away.
April 29th. After a rainout on the 27th, Schilling and the bullpen tossed another gem last night, beating Tampa Bay 6-0. Tampa Bay only got a single runner as far as third base. And while I like the D-Rays, I sometimes think of the Red Sox as my baseball wife and not-so-sweet Lou Piniella's Devil Rays as my baseball mistress, I have to admit they are reverting to type after a hopeful start. But of course, the Red Sox's 13-6 start is also part of a pattern I have observed over the years. Call it Bo Sox Happy Hoop Days. The way it works is simple enough. The Red Sox have a tendency to tear up the American League until the NBA playoffs wrap up. After that, more often than not, they sputter. And leave us face it, a 2-game lead over Baltimore and a 4-game lead over the Yankees, while better than a poke in the eye with a sharp stick, really ain't all that much. Of course, it beats being behind, but I think I'll wait until after July 4th to decide whether or not Schilling and company are for real. Footnote A on today's entry. Our Mr. Kim, he of the restless middle finger, is back from sore shoulder woes today, and a stint in Pawtucket. He's supposed to be limited to 75 pitches, after which Tim Wakefield will come in to relieve. Damn. It's a day-night doubleheader, and I was kind of hoping Timmy would pull a Wilbur Wood and start both games. Nor am I joking. Footnote B on today's entry. Although Derek Jeter's hitless streak has now reached 0-32, tying a Yankee record, the immortal Jimmy Winn in 1977, the Bombers beat the Oakland A's for the second straight night. They've only picked up half a game on Boston because of that rainout. But the win suggests that Boston's weekend sweep in the Bronx may have had more to do with Red Sox pitching, defense, and the bat of Manny Ramirez than it did with any Yankee funk. It may be too early to declare the Red Sox the class of the AL East, but it may not be too early to at least suspect that this year they outclass the New York Yankees.
I check the standings to see how many games up we are on the O's, too. And discover we've got the best record in baseball. I think that's got to be wrong, since we opened 3-4. But no, only the Twins and the pitching-rich Marlins are anywhere near us. Game 1 is BK versus Victor Zambrano, who's had some success against us. Dauber's starting at first base, and on the first play of the game lets a grounder slip under his glove for an E. Welcome back, Dauber. It's a brilliant spring day, sunny in the mid-70s. Because this is a rainout of a night game, the Sox have to let ticket holders sit in sections 34 and 35 in dead center, which normally for day games are sealed off with a black tarp for the hitter's backdrop. The Sox have solved the problem by giving everyone sitting in the sections a t-shirt the same forest green as the seats. Both pitchers are throwing well, but the defenses behind them are scuffling, as if the idea of playing an extra game today doesn't agree with either team. Bill Miller and Doug Mirabelli lose a foul pop in the sun. It drops not between them, but 10 feet to the side. Later, Billy and Cesar Crespo go back for a short fly in left. Manny comes racing in, calling them off, almost collides with Crespo, and drops the ball. A play you rarely see in the second. Jose Cruz Jr. is leading off first when Tino Martinez hits a screamer right at him. Cruz doesn't have time to go right or left, he just ducks. The liner skims off his back, barely nicking him, but Dauber points to let the ump know. The first base ump says it never touched him, bringing Francona out to argue, at which time, without consulting anyone, the second base ump calls Cruz out. Go Blue. Kim looks sharp, getting groundouts with the ball down, then climbing the ladder with a good rising fastball. I saw his first start for the Sox last year in Pittsburgh, an efficient win, and he looks much the same. He's up to 70 pitches after 5 and finishes the inning with a strikeout. As he walks off, the fans stand. Remarkable, since this is the first time he's pitched since giving us the finger. 5 innings, 1 hit, no runs. Come home, Byung-hyun, all is forgiven. Zambrano's cruising too, striking out the side in the 4th. But in the 5th, with a man on, he gets behind David Ortiz 3-0. Zambrano obviously hasn't read the scouting report, because David's always got the green light. He plants a meatball in the sea of green shirts in Section 35. It's all we need as Wake comes on to baffle the D-Rays for 2 more innings, then Timlin, then Embry. The final's 4-0, our 3rd straight shutout. The pen hasn't been scored on in over 30 innings. We get on the road to Game 2 just as Game 1's ending. We've got a table up in the new right field roof terrace and Steve's dugout seats. Trudy has papers to grade, so Caitlin and her friend Lindsay will take the good seats first and will switch after the 4th. It's turned into a warm evening, and Yawkey Way is a carnival. A guy on stilts in a Sox uniform tosses a puffy ball to random people in the crowd. People are having their pictures taken with Wally in the big red chair on the sidewalk. The guys at Cambridge Soundworks are handing out their Sox bumper stickers, "I Believe" and "Turn It Up." And we take a minute to gawk at the high-definition TVs in their little alcove. Then it's the long walk out to the big concourse in right field. The stairs we take up to the roof are new, concrete and steep. The elevator shaft is in place, but there's no elevator in it yet. The views of Back Bay and the park at every turning are spectacular. I'm puffing by the time we make it to the top, and the low sun in the west is blinding. We get to our home plate-shaped table in the 2nd row and test the swiveling seats, the same as on the Monster. But there's not as much room as on the Monster. The wire fence digs into my knees when I try to turn toward home, and we're much farther from the action. On the way up, we pass the very last row of the bleachers in Section 43, joking that the corner seat there was probably the worst seat in Fenway. We're a good 2 stories higher, above the retired numbers attached to the roof's facing, nearly eye level with the top of the pesky pole. The view is the one you'd have if they built a 2nd deck, as they were threatening to with the new Fenway. It's as far away as I've ever sat at a Red Sox game. It's also windy, a breeze coming over the back of the deck, whipping napkins off the tables and out over the front railing, where an updraft floats them high into the air. I'm glad it's warm now, because it's going to be cold later. Lowe's going against lefty Damian Moss, a recent retread, so I think we've got the advantage. The first batter Lowe faces, speed burner Carl Crawford, bonks a double off the wall. Julio Lugo, known best for banging his ex-wife's head off the hood of a car, "Hey Lugo, restrain yourself," bunts, and Lowe misplays it. A grounder by Woonsocket's own Rocco Baldelli scores Crawford, ending our scoreless streak, and the crowd's not happy. We're even less happy when Robert Fick doubles to right, scoring Lugo. Steph shakes his head. "It's just like the Yankee game we saw Lowe throw here." I overhear that Jeter's homered in the 1st at the stadium, breaking his hitless streak. All good things must come to an end. We come up to bat down 2-0. I realize the girls have forgotten to take my glove, for protection, seriously, and hustle down there. I'm underneath the grandstand when I hear the crowd cheer for Johnny. I guess that he's on base. Another cheer, this time for Bill Miller, so probably a single. A bigger cheer, it's a long way. And I catch a monitor by a concession stand in time to see Johnny scoot home with our 1st run. I reach the seats as Manny's batting. The girls think I'm nuts bringing down the glove, but I insist. "Lindsay," I say, "you're getting a ball tonight." Moss is all over the place. He throws one to the backstop, moving Bill Miller and Ortiz over. "Watch the ball," I tell the girls, "because it's scuffed." The ump tosses it to Andrew, who looks back and sees me and the girls. Lindsay stands, and Andrew throws it right to her, only to have this linebacker-sized guy in a muscle shirt in the front row reach back and snatch it away from her. The section boos, and the poacher realizes what he's done and dumps it in Caitlin's lap. So Lindsay gets her ball. And Manny singles, scoring Bill Miller to tie the game. Tech rocks a three-run shot, McCarty singles, Kapler doubles. That's it for Moss. 7 earned runs in 1/3 of an inning. For a guy trying to make a comeback, that's gotta hurt. In the top of the third, Rocco Baldelli stings a tailing liner to right that Gabe Kapler makes a great diving catch on. When Kapler comes up with 2 down in the bottom of the inning, he must still be pumped, because he bunts for a base hit, digging hard and diving head first to beat the throw. "I don't know," I say, and explain to Steph that with a big lead, it's generally a sign of disrespect for the other club to bunt for a hit. Then Kapler steals second. "We'll see if they throw at one of our guys," I say. Lowe's done after 7. Not a great start, but he'll get a W thanks to good run support. Falk closes, striking out Crawford and Lugo to finish it. It's a 7-3 final, a relatively uneventful game, and a sweep of the D-Rays. The Yanks have swept Oakland, who should be seriously worried. But no one's worried about the Yanks here, not tonight. We've won 6 in a row, and the crowd leaves the park happy. Even the talk radio guys on WEEI can't gripe. And who should we hear but Angry Bill, who says, "Smooth sailing. That's what the captain of the Titanic said." I get an email from Steve.
"Last time I looked in on the nightcap, the Sox were up 7-3, and Lowe was throwing in that queerly careless way he sometimes has, as though only a quarter of his mind is on the game. If we're going to lose one we should win, this would be my candidate. Second half of a doubleheader? D-Rays feeling embarrassed by Gabe Kapler for one? Sure."
So you caught Kapler's bunt and steal, too. At first I thought it was unsporting, but hell, it was only the third. He didn't get plunked, but late in the game the ump rang him up on 3 pitches, only one of which was decidedly a strike. I guess the game polices itself. April 30th. Thinking of Kapler last night, I wonder, with Trot due back soon, if he was trying to remind management of his special abilities. With Ellis Burks on the DL, he may be safe for a while, but there are no guarantees. So far, Francona has shown he's willing to start Millar, Crespo, and McCarty in the outfield, and I imagine we'll see Dauber out there eventually. In the mail is a stack of score sheets from the Remy Report. Now, instead of having to buy the same $4 program all month, I can just flip a single sheet over and fold it into my pocket when I'm done. Also in the mail, a talisman. A ball signed by Sox playoff and World Series hero, how often do you hear those words together, Dave Henderson. I add Hendu to the ball case like the crucial ingredient in a witch's brew. We're still in a rain delay with Charlie Moore, Nesson's mad fisherman, when the Yankee final crawls by. They beat KC for their 4th straight. And 10 minutes before midnight, when the Rangers finally call it after the crowds waited through a 3-hour delay, the Yanks pick up a half game on us. The game's rescheduled for tomorrow at 5 Central Time, meaning we'll be playing our 2nd doubleheader in 3 days. Good thing our starting pitching's deep.